Hi friends, my name is Professor Karan Chawla. I'm a brand management professional and I will be taking your session on product brand management. Over my career, I've managed 15 large brands in full-time jobs and I've consulted with over 50 companies for their brand strategy, brand communication and marketing communication needs. Currently, I run my own brand communication and brand strategy setup called Inverted Triangle, and I also teach. This is one of my hobbies. So I'll be taking this course on product brand management with you. Let us first start with chapter one, brand and branding, a brief history. So the objective of this session is to understand the evolution of branding. Before we actually get into brand management, we have to understand what brands are about. Where did they really come from? So in order to identify one's own property, people have been branding cattle for a very long time. And this started as far back as the Stone Ages. Think about this scenario. People are living together in a small community. There are, say, 30 families in a small dwelling, and one family has some cattle, another family has other cattle. Now people have to make sure that their neighbors don't take over their cattle, which is why I, as a person, would have my own unique brand, which I could put on my cattle and which will identify these cattle as uniquely mine. And this is the basic fundamental of where brands have come from. Even if you see cave paintings from France to the rock shelters in India, all the ancient cave painting sites, you will see the evidence of branding in the Stone Ages. The branding as an unambiguous sign of possession was actually postulated by somebody called James Cryer. The appearance of species of animals post-domestication was a part of this. Basically, identification of one's own domesticated animals was a part of my sign of possession of these animals. Branding would be a part of it. Branding the animal would be a part of it. The other part of it would be you domesticate the animals so that if you release the animal in the wild, they would actually come back to you rather than being in the wild. This tamed animal's behavior would indicate that it has an owner and therefore belongs to one person. If you look at the history of product branding, you have to know that roughly 1,000 different Roman potters' marks have been identified only in the first 3 centuries of the Roman Empire, which gives you an idea that beyond animal branding, product branding also started in ancient civilizations. Now, these Roman potters would put marks on their urns or their vases or their products in order to differentiate their products from the products of any other potters all over the empire. And as these vases or these urns or these other products would travel from one city to another city, their fame, the potter's fame, would spread. And people, even in the far reaches of the empire, would actually know that this particular vase was made by this particular potter because it has been made in a certain way and it has his unique mark. A large number of individuals were actually producing a relatively small number of goods, and trademarks on pottery have been identified as far back as 3000 BC in Mesopotamia. But that is not all. Even in other ancient civilizations like ancient Egypt, for instance, at the time of the pharaohs, brick makers have been putting marks on their bricks. Quarry marks, stone cutter signs have been found as far back as 6000 years ago. So you can now see that beginning from the Stone Ages all the way to ancient civilizations, advanced ancient civilizations like ancient Egypt, Mesopotamia, even the Roman Empire, you see trademarks, you see brands, you see an attempt by human beings to differentiate their products from somebody else's products, their cattle from somebody else's cattle. The advent of product branding actually started with these quarry marks. The quarry marks indicated the source of the stones used in buildings. The stone cutter signs were painted or carved into the stone, helping workers to prove their claim to wages. Similar marks and markings were also observed in ancient buildings in Greece, Israel, Syria, and Turkey. As we move on from the ancient markets and we move towards medieval markets, we realize that medieval stone makers in Germany, actually developed a very elaborate system for crafting individualized marks that identified their work. But the purposes of these marks were exactly the same. The purposes of these marks were in order to differentiate one person's work from another person's work. One person's one stonemason's work from another stonemason's work. Bricks and tiles from Mesopotamia and Egypt bore inscriptions indicating the name of the monarch. Even if you look at the fact that all ancient monarchs had coins distributed across their kingdoms or empires with their names and faces branded on the coins, that is also a form of branding. Roman builders actually stamped their bricks and tiles to indicate the source of raw materials used. And you see, this is a practice that is even continued to this day. If you see any bricks used in construction, on a construction site for instance, you will see that a brick that comes out of the kiln will actually have the stamp of the company that has made it. And this is no different from how it was done in the medieval or the ancient markets. Shopkeepers used to advertise their products by hanging pictures in their shops. So actually, brand communication for products started way back in the ancient times. Developments of logos was traced. Retailers used symbols to depict the quality and specialty of their products. Trade fairs had become a practice. And even brand piracy was a practice. Not a practice per se, but brand piracy existed even in medieval times, medieval and ancient times. In fact, manufacturers had already formed manufacturing guilds in ancient markets. The key objective of this, of course, was to be able to produce standardized products. Inspection and prohibition was exercised, and there was actually a punishment for defective products made. Now, how would you actually say that this product is defective and has been made by this particular mason or this particular vendor, this particular potter? It was identified because of the individual potter's mark. Baker marking law was passed in the medieval times, and the first advertisement in the newspaper actually appeared in 1625. In the 1200s, 1300s and 1400s in medieval England, for instance, the copyright laws actually advanced to a certain level. There were times when the nobles of old would use rings on their fingers with specific unique marks to seal letters or to sign documents or to ensure that people knew that if they were passing a decree, it was actually them passing a decree because it was their unique brand. Now, if the husband passed away and the wife wanted to use the same sign, there was actually a case when a widow approached the government and said that people are not recognizing her using the husband's sign. So the government at that time actually allowed her to use that sign, and that is another way in which copyright was transferred from husband to wife. Copyright laws therefore have actually existed for a very long time. As far back as the 1600s in the UK, there was a case where there was an actual cloth manufacturer, somebody who used to use superior cloth in his products and had a specific logo, had a specific trademark, and therefore had a big good reputation across the empire. His logo was infringed upon by somebody who was using inferior quality cloth. And this guy, the first person who was using the superior quality cloth, actually got relief from the government for this. The other person was fined, penalized. As we move towards the Industrial Revolution, we understand that machines actually took over most of the manual processes. Brands like Levi's and Tabasco here were born. Manufactured merchandise without brand names were also prevalent. You have to understand that in these cases, what happened was, brands became inherent to the product. The company name became the brand name, and we'll look more into that a little later. For example, in USA, during the gold rush, there were a lot of railroads that needed to be built. There were a lot of railroads that needed to be built. There were a number of railroad workers who used to work in the US, and they had a specific need gap. They had a problem. Their problem was that their pants weren't sturdy enough. They had to do a rough job day in and day out, and their pants would tear. So they would keep going to the tailors to get their pants sewed back, or they would have had to buy new pants, which wasn't great for the railroad workers because they didn't get that much money. Levi Strauss identified this need gap, and he innovated with this material that we now call denim. So he actually innovated with thicker cotton, higher quality pants were formed, and thus came into existence the first jeans named Levi Strauss and Company. Today, of course, the brand is called Levi's, but at that time the brand itself was Levi Strauss and Company. Now, all this was also possible because a certain standardization in production happened. If all products that come out of a certain factory are standard and you put a brand on them, then one also understands, the consumer also understands, that I know that if I buy this particular brand, I will get a certain kind of quality. Branding is an investment. Now, protecting investment by branding in products was started during the Industrial Revolution because manufacturing took off. There were lots of factories producing a lot of goods, and it was very important for people to maintain ownership over their copyrights, over their brand names. Manufacturing and marketing in turn advanced visual communication and trademarks. Now, as a number of factories were producing a number of products, it became very essential for people to be able to differentiate their products. Of course, just as the Industrial Revolution was starting, it wasn't such a big problem because in one product category, there would be probably a couple of companies making their products. But as you can see, the case is today, the basis of differentiating your product or your brand in those times that were made, those bases of differentiations actually hold true even today. So the companies started to promote their packaged goods. And this was a great way to actually say that, you know, this particular good is mine because now I'm promoting this packaged good. One company promoting a certain packaged good means that they're taking ownership to that particular package group. Now let's look at some of the dimensions of brands. Brands have three basic dimensions: differentiation, legal protection, and functional communication. Now, simply put, without differentiation, there is no brand. Brands don't exist without differentiation. Go back to the Stone Ages. If I put a unique mark on a cow, that cow is mine. But if that mark is not unique, how will anyone else differentiate between that cow and another cow? If, for example, my mark and my neighbor's mark look similar or so similar that they can be confused for each other, then there is absolutely no point having my unique brand. Because if my brand is not unique enough, it can be the product that I'm putting my brand on, in this case the cattle, can be confused for my neighbor's cattle, for my neighbor's product. That is why differentiation is a very core dimension of brands. Without differentiation, there is no brand. Legal protection. You have to have legal protection because once you've differentiated, once you've created a unique trademark, a unique mark that identifies the products of your company, you have to be able to protect them legally. If you can't protect them legally, then that also means that somebody else can use them. So for example, if I'm producing shirts under my trademark, and if I'm producing great quality shirts, but my trademark is not protected, somebody else can use that trademark to create inferior quality shirts, and they can feed off of my brand equity. So which is why I have to ensure that there is a legal recourse I can take. I can take that legal recourse only if I have protected my trademark. Therefore, legal protection is a very important dimension of brands. Next is functional communication. Now, once I have a brand, even if I have legally protected it, I have to ensure that this brand is communicated to the public. I have to communicate to my consumers saying, what is my brand selling? What is the product that I have put my brand on? What is its benefit for you as a consumer? If I don't do that, the brand need not even exist. Which is why these three are the main dimensions of brand. As we move into the 20th century, we realize that post-industrial revolution, mass marketing was invented. Because now you get to a point where production has boomed, the spending power with consumers has boomed, and human instincts now have to be targeted and harnessed. You have to actually, I'm talking about throughout the 60s, 70s and 80s, especially in the West, especially in the US and Western European markets, where capitalism was booming. There were so many products within the same product category, there were so many brands within the same product category, that to be able to differentiate or to be able to build preference, people had to finally rely on human instincts, on insights. Insight mining, therefore, became a very important thing. And marketing has evolved so much in the last 80 years, 80, 90 years, that it hasn't evolved so much in the entire history of human beings, even though brands have existed. So the basic core of brands being differentiated, that has existed since the Stone Ages. But mass marketing, insight mining, human instinct targeting, that all has actually come on more recently, in the last 80 to 90 years. One stellar example of this is tobacco companies, how they pioneered new advertising techniques. Tobacco companies, especially like Marlboro, for instance, have pioneered this technique of being able to mine an insight with the consumer and capitalize on it. So for example, the Marlboro man, who was the ultimate symbol of machismo, was used as very specific user imagery in order to be able to emotionally influence a potential user, saying, depicting in other words, that if you smoke a Marlboro cigarette, you can look like this man to other people. And who wouldn't want to look like that symbol of machismo? Tobacco companies were the pioneers in using such emotional insights. Emotion in branding therefore became revolutionized because of especially tobacco companies. As branding has entered the 20th century, applied psychological theories have started being used in advertising. We have implemented the concepts of behaviors into advertising. Practice of brand sponsorship programs has been popularized. The brands have acquired a new dimension, which is emotional. The concept of commercial sponsorship has been carried over to television. So over here, we have to try and look at the US of the 20th century. So there were plenty of important sporting events, big sporting events like NBA or like American football, the Super Bowl. All these garnered a lot of viewers, especially on television. As soon as the advent of color television happened, and as soon as television was widely available to a large number of people, suddenly the viewership for something like a Super Bowl went through the roof. The brands which had till now focused on marketing through advertising through newspapers, for instance, or television commercials, saw a brilliant opportunity. They saw an opportunity to actually sponsor an event that reaches out to a large number of people, and therefore piggyback on those associations as well. So when I'm watching Super Bowl, or if I'm watching a big sporting event, at that time my associations are all great. I'm enjoying myself. I'm looking at the television. I'm enjoying myself. I'm relaxed in that environment. If I see a brand message which is also relevant to me, I'll be far more likely to actually absorb that brand message and act upon it. This is where the concept of commercial sponsorship carried over to television. The concept of brand personality was championed. The concept of brand loyalty was championed. The concept of market segmentation was championed. Now you have to understand that in these times, suddenly there was a difference in the way marketing had to be done. In earlier times, just before say the 50s and the 60s, the number of products in a certain product category was still a little lesser. So people could just say functionally, my pen is really good, buy a Waterman. And people would go and buy a Waterman because there wouldn't be too many other choices. But as the 60s and the 70s dawned, the number of choices became too many. And therefore, concepts like personality were championed, concepts like loyalty were championed, because if you didn't have brand loyalty, you were likely to buy a product once and then shift to another product because there were so many choices. There were people who were fighting on cost, there were people who were fighting on quality, but the ones that started fighting on the basis of their brands actually were the ones who won out and ones who still exist to this day. So if I have to sell a luxury or a lifestyle product to a consumer, I also have to make a story in the mind of the consumer. It's very important. For example, you see that in today's world, if a builder is trying to sell a luxury apartment to a consumer which is worth a few crores and has certain amenities, to be able to attract consumers to that kind of project, the brand has to tell a story. The brand has to put a picture in the head of the consumer, wherein the consumer actually visualizes himself or herself in a room or in a house with maybe a 360 degree sea view, with maybe an indoor pool or something. That visualization became extremely important. Brands have been developed to become storytelling vehicles. And these things have really become important in brand communication, to be able to actually express what brands can possibly give to the consumers. Most of these benefits will be emotional, but still, these are important emotional benefits, and they have actually made the difference between a customer buying a brand or not buying a brand. So let's summarize this session. First of all, branding is old. It's as old as the Stone Age. It's as old as people living together in communities in prehistoric times. Since the very beginning of branding, it has aimed at protection of one's own property rather than and for merchandising. Brands have been seen in even Stone Age paintings. Strategic brand management, which has actually evolved over the last 50, 60, 80 years, it actually involves design, implementation of marketing programs, activities to build, measure, and manage brand equity. Concepts like brand loyalty, brand personality, storytelling, they've all come up in the last 60 to 80 years, and that is all a part of strategic brand management. Over this course, we will learn all of these concepts separately, and we'll get into details of how brands can actually be formed and managed. Thank you.